Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the studios of KSFR and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like to welcome Chris Diestler. He's the general manager of True Believers Comics and Gallery and cartoonist Jet Boynton. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, thanks for having us.
It's great to have you.
Thanks a lot.
It's very interesting that comics have risen to an art form far beyond anything that probably the original creators of Superman comics ever imagined. It is an art form, is it not?
Absolutely.
What is it like these days? There's a huge variety of comic book art, cartoon art.
It's just like any other creative form. I mean, if you go into a bookstore, there's a section for mystery, a section for history, what have you, and comics are no different.
What are some of the sections in, for example, your comic book store?
Oh, you know, if someone comes in asking for how-to stuff, we have a how-to section. If someone comes in asking for reportage, there's quite a bit of that lately that's winning awards, like Joe Sacco.
What do you mean by reportage?
Reportage, kind of like real-life journalism. The reportage that it comes up in comics a lot has to do with the cartoonist being in a foreign land and kind of observing and reporting on the cultures and the events that are happening around them.
It's like documentary filmmaking without the filmmaking.
Very interesting. There's also a kind of connection to animation that I've noticed. I love beautiful hand-drawn animation, and I guess the still version of that is alive and well in comic art.
Oh, absolutely. There's a very thin line between animation and comic booking.
One gets the impression that a lot of the guys working in animation really want to be working in comics, but animation actually pays them.
And comics doesn't?
Not so much.
Animation's a much more lucrative field, I think.
Really?
Especially if you can get something, you know, on Saturday morning TV for the kids or on Nickelodeon or Cartoon Network or whatever.
All right.
Something where you get lots of product licensing.
A lot of times they go back and forth. There are a lot of animators that put out comics, but you get the feeling they kind of just do it just because they want to do it, not because they think there's a lot of money in it necessarily.
Like with the reportage books, there's a wave of anthology books that are specifically animators who are stepping outside animation and doing their comics stuff. There are a couple of guys who are fairly prominent in the animation industry but are very prominent in comics, and they kind of organize, you know, a bunch of their fellow animators to put together some stories and put out work. Scott Morse is one of them. He works now at Pixar, but he worked for Hanna-Barbera when it was Hanna-Barbera, and then he was still there when it turned into Cartoon Network. So,
now, how is this whole culture of comic art and animation art seen compared to the mainstream art world? Is it taken seriously?
I'm sorry, could you rephrase the question?
There have been some pretty prominent museum and gallery exhibitions of comics art, both historical and current comics art exhibitions. So there is a little bit more notice taken, I think, but I don't know. You'd have to ask somebody who is more connected to the fine arts world how seriously they take it.
I think there's a little bit of cross-pollination, but I think it's kind of a new thing by and large. Well, for example, Art Spiegelman, who won the Pulitzer for his comic book Mouse, his right. wife, I think, edits The New Yorker. And so people that he knows or people that work in his style get some kind of art cred in the New York literary circles, I think, because of that.
Plus, Spiegelman also was, still is a big deal in the comics world because several of his original Mouse pages are in the permanent collection at the MoMA. So he's done quite a lot for comics as a serious art form.
And there's I can think of a couple of examples here in Santa Fe alone. Jamie Chase, who has you know had his fine art up for years, not just in Santa Fe but in San Francisco and here and there, and just recently got a call from a guy at DC Comics. They're the ones. They're pretty much the big daddy, the grandpappy of comic labels. They called him up and asked him to do a Batman book or something like that.
Jamie is kind of like one of those animators. He's for many years now made a very respectable living doing fine art, but I think he'd really rather be doing comics.
When I was thinking about the whole world of comics, I thought, well, isn't it funny that the word comic is even used? Because some of them are not funny.
Yeah, they're not funny books anymore, by and large.
Yeah.
Scott McCloud, who's kind of the big thinker of comics, he's our greatest living theorist.
He's
the
Zen philosopher of comics.
He distinguishes comic as being humorous and comics with an S, even though it's a singular form. It distinguishes the art form. And it just there have been a lot of attempts to give it something more, you know, something more apt in the way of designation, something that they've called it sequential art. They've called it graphic storytelling, something that maybe makes it sound like a serious thing. But comics is what's known. If you speak to the person on the street and you say comics, they'll get to
they
where
might look
you
at
are.
You and think you're talking about Jerry Seinfeld, though.
That is true.
But if you say sequential art, they definitely won't know what you're talking about.
chances are.
We're talking to Chris Diesler and Jet Boynton. One of the things that I think has developed since the early days of comics is the nature of the stories. It's not all about superheroes anymore.
It's funny when you talk about the early days of comics, because I've been looking a lot at the turn of the century stuff, which in a lot of ways was the birth of the current form of, and not the turn of the last century, but the century
1900.
Before. 1900s. Guys like Winsor McCay, and I've really been studying a guy named Lionel Feininger recently, and they had
he's
no.
He's a German artist. He's a quote
he's
unquote
a
fine artist.
Very famous fine artist and graphic designer. He was an instructor at the Bauhaus School of Design. But he had a very short comics career in 1906. Pretty much from 1906 to 1906, Lionel Feininger worked in the comics world.
And what was his work like?
It's gorgeous. He's got a, like I said, a design background.
It's very stylized.
Very stylized. He did two strips in 1906, The Kinder Kids and Wee Willie's World. And they're the strips in those days, that like I said, it's kind of the birth of the modern comics form, and they were one full broadsheet of the newspaper was a single strip. They were a main feature in the newspapers of those days. The comics form kind of came out of the fact that they had just come up with color for mass production. And they were trying to figure out a way to showcase their mass production color, but color photographs still didn't reproduce. Plus the color photographs in that day was hand-tinted photograph anyways. And so they were trying to come up with something that would, you know, show off how cool their color printing process was. And some clever graphic artist started doing stories in color pictures, and that's when comics really took off. And they were superstars of that day. They were huge. I mean, the Winsor McCay was legendary in his day. He was also one of the pioneers of animation. He created some of the very first moving pictures.
What were some of their stories about in those early days?
McKay's most famous was Little Nemo in Slumberland, which was a really great comics type exploration. It was a very simple setup. A little boy would, on the last panel of every strip, he would wake up in his bed in some like tangle of sheets or having fallen out of bed, something whimsical. But leading up to that, he'd have this incredible dream, you know, and McKay would beautifully detail like his nocturnal adventures.
Style was very kind of Art Deco.
Oh, yeah.
Wouldn't you say?
Yeah, definitely.
A early Maxfield Parrish kind of feel.
Just beautiful. McKay was a fantastic draftsman, and according to legend, he also had a photographic memory, which was really key for the kind of stuff that he was capturing, because he'd show things like the Taj Mahal, and this was, you know, 1906, when most people wouldn't likely even see a photograph of it, and he would take them there, and he'd be able to, you know, visualize the room from all different angles and really take people on a tour of these exotic locales, show them lions and elephants and all this amazing stuff. It was kind of like a traveling show, but on paper.
As an artist, do you turn to, obviously you turn to the history of other cartoonists, comic art. What about, do you also turn to fine artists, oil painting and all that for your inspiration?
I think it's kind of necessary. Comics are actually a really demanding art form, I find, not only because you're combining storytelling with the actual rendering of the image, which takes a lot, but in that you also, in order to tell a story, understandably, you have to combine a lot of elements and you have to visualize a fairly complete world for people. And we've got hundreds of years of fine art now to you don't have to reinvent the wheel. You kind of look at what's gone before and try to understand.
There's an awful lot of ripping that goes on, swiping. But usually an artist, if he's going to reference an earlier source, will actually, you know, put it in the signature, so and so after so and so. But they may steal a layout from Maxfield Parrish, or I've seen people do that on covers, especially
Mucha. People love Mucha. You see him all over the place.
There's a gal here in town that does those kind of paintings. She does fantasy art.
Now, do you have a lot of collaborations between storytellers and artists? I would think that the burden of those of doing those two forms is a lot for one person.
It certainly is. In the production side of comics, the big studios, the Marvel and DC, they long ago divided up those chores so that they could speed up their process.
Kind of an assembly line affair.
The thing that we were talking about earlier with the ghosting is actually very prevalent, which is a fine arts tradition too, having a studio of apprentices.
Painting the little background landscapes or the cubits.
Well, not just that, but I don't know how many drawings you see with Matt Groening's signature on it for The Simpsons that aren't actually done by Matt Groening.
Uh-huh.
He's probably got 50 people that sign his name. Walt Disney, same thing.
Because they're doing his style, his stuff kind of thing. Japan is they're really into that. You don't see writer artist teams in Japan. Generally, it's one creator for manga, except that one creator has, you know, as many as like 60 guys doing stuff.
Or they'll have a studio and collectively they'll call themselves Clamp.
One name.
Or something. But Clamp, for example, in the world of Japanese manga is extremely popular, especially with teenage girls. And
it's a single identity, but it's four young women.
Is it only four?
Maybe more.
They sure put out a lot of work for only four girls, but wow, yeah.
Now, the length of the stories is something that's also changed a great deal, to the point where you have something that is called graphic novels.
Indeed.
Do they really qualify as novels?
Sometimes.
If you're talking page count, and also literary, that was the man who came up with the term graphic novels was a gentleman by the name of Will Eisner, who started doing comics work in the 1930s and was productive all the way to the end of his life, which was 2 years ago now?
Fairly recently.
Recently, at the age of 87, he was still producing graphic novels. But he came up with that term because he was envisioning something that would have
more weight,
literary implications. He wanted to deal with more serious stories, less tights.
when the term graphic novel first started to proliferate, there was a lot of, oh, you can't call them that. People will think they're full of sex and violence. They're graphic. Oh. And some of them are, I suppose. But, I mean, they're called graphic novels just because they're pictures as opposed to not pictures.
Now, another thing about comic books is that they are very collectible, and there's a huge trade in them, and some of them are also extremely valuable.
True. That's... Mostly the old ones that were released before the big paper drives in the World War II. During World War II, moms would clean out the attic for the war effort, and they'd recycle the paper and stuff. So those ones in particular are exceptionally rare and valuable to collectors.
In a store like yours, do you have collectible stuff like that, or is it mostly stuff that's new, that's come out, just like any bookstore would have more new books?
As far as collectible stuff goes, it's kind of catch-as-catch-can. I mean, sometimes people will bring in that kind of stuff, and we buy it from them. I just got some old Tarzans that Dell put out, and I don't know, Dell was one of the biggest, hugest companies of all time before they folded in the 70s.
Collectibility is really tricky. People have this impression of collectibles as being worth this much today, and it'll be worth more tomorrow. But it actually moves much more like a trading market, a stock market, and there are trends, and your collectible can actually drastically lose value from one time to the next. And I think the people who really are serious about making money buying and selling comics have to pay a lot of attention to it now. They have to follow the market and figure out, you know, buy low, sell high. So it's a tricky thing to talk about the collectability of comics.
I wouldn't recommend anybody get into comics now with the intent of, you know, putting their kids through college in 30 years.
Unless, like I say, you want to spend all your time doing just that. I mean, it can be a full-time job. We know one guy at least who was doing it for a couple of years, like very seriously, and he would move huge lots of comics and acquire huge lots more. So.
Yeah.
And was able actually to make some money because he knew what he was doing.
Yeah, kept buying lots of comics, so I assume he was getting money doing it.
There's all sorts of looks to comics. They're not only the kind of comics that you do, Jet Boynton, which are hand-drawn, but there's also collage. There's what are they called, the ones that are made with photographs using actors?
They tend to be called fumetti. I believe it's an Italian word, but they're seen a lot in Europe and Latin America. They're really popular in those parts of the world, so we have an Italian name for them because you don't see a lot of fumetti in the States.
I haven't seen an American-produced fumetti since early 80s, maybe.
Probably.
It seems sort of cheesy to our sensibilities, but they're incredibly popular in Mexico.
They're huge.
As are comics. I mean, a comic book artist in France is actually kind of a celebrity, whereas here they're kind of, you bum.
The environment.
What do? You make comics?
The environment in a comic book store in Europe is really, really interesting. Their comics format tends to be larger pages, and all the books tend to be hardbound. They're very elegant artifact books, where here we like fold a pamphlet in half and staple it together and done.
What are some of the most famous European comics that people might have heard of or should keep an eye out for?
Tintin.
Asterix.
Right.
Yeah. There's an artist by the name – well, he goes by the name of Mobius. It's Jean Girard, I believe.
Yeah.
But he also does, you know, costume designs for movies, and he doesn't just do comics, but he's really highly regarded as an artist. But he doesn't really do quote-unquote fine art. He does comic art, but comic art in France is such a fine art that he's regarded as a fine artist almost.
So that's what you might call a cultural difference between there and here.
I would say so.
There's a fantastic up-and-coming new generation of French cartoonists. A lot of them are being republished in English now by a company called First Second, but including Jean Safar, who's one of my heroes currently. He did a book called The Rabbi's Cat, and he's got a just beautiful, lively cartooning style, very expressionistic.
They've won a lot of awards.
Yeah.
First Second for the things they're publishing. You know, there's a lot of boutique publishing labels out there. It's not all capes and tights. And actually, all the awards tend to go to people like Johann Safar and First Second for things like Klezmer and The Rabbi's Cat and what have you, rather than, you know, I mean, I can't even remember the last time Superman won an award.
Kind of sadly for the specialty shop industry, but the big market for comics these days is Barnes & Noble and Borders, and they're definitely looking for more book-type comics. They sell huge amounts of Japanese manga, but U.S. books that have the versatility of manga are going to do better in that market than the traditional superhero stuff.
Yeah, the capes really get kind of relegated to the dark corner somewhere. It's kind of where the comics world in general is relegated in our society sometimes.
We're talking to Chris Diesler and Jet Boynton. There is an event coming up, which I find fascinating, called 24-Hour Comics?
Mm-hmm. 24-Hour Comics Day.
24-Hour Comics Day. What's the date of it?
That will be Saturday, October 20th. We're going to start our event at noon promptly, Saturday the 20th.
And we'll go till noon on Sunday the 21st.
Everyone's going to have cramps in their hands, but about halfway through.
How does it work? What's the rules? What's the deal?
I think it's fueled by caffeine mostly.
caffeine and pizza.
Is it a contest?
It's not a contest so much as – well, it's not a contest against others so much as a contest – against yourself.
Yeah, the only competition is between yourself and your own sense of your limitations.
Your ability to stay awake for 24 hours and be working that entire time, for one.
So you've got 24 hours to produce the ideas that you produce a 24-page comic book with a cover.
Mm-hmm.
Right, 24 pages, 24 hours, roughly a page an hour. The ideal is envisioned by the guy who came up with it. It's that Scott McCloud guy I was talking about earlier. Was one artist, one comic, 24 hours, 24 pages, written, drawn, conceived, technically.
So you're not allowed to think of it the day before, the week before,
and make
notes.
That would be a violation of Mr. McCloud's rules.
I'm sure some people do give it some thought before they come in, but it's cheating. Don't do it.
I don't know how you can tell yourself that you're going to do this thing and then not think about it until the clock starts.
Right. Yeah. Well, what I was reading in Scott McCloud's book was that people gather their other books and art materials and pens and pencils and sort of inspirational things, and then a great amount of caffeine and carbohydrates and protein around them, and then when the thing goes, they can start thinking of their idea.
Yeah, you can bring together any sort of materials or reference or whatever you might think might be useful, and that's totally okay in Mr. McCloud's book, but you can't start doing, you know, sketches of the characters. You can't outline the story.
So you've done
these. I have. I've attempted to.
Have you finished?
I finished a story. It was only about 12 pages.
So oh.
It was what McCloud refers to as a noble failure variant of the 24 page.
Because you finished the story, but it wasn't 24 pages.
Right.
Mm.
And so
12 pages in 24 hours is still pretty impressive in my book.
I would say so.
Considering I give myself, generally speaking, 8 hours per page, I think I was really pushing myself to get the 12 pages. But I want to find the way to unlock the full 24 pages, because it's been done over and over again by many different artists. So I have to believe that I could do it. I just have to figure out how to break through.
Are there people all over Santa Fe, all over the world? I mean, is this a national and international thing? This
it's international 24? Now, I think.
Oh, fully international.
So everybody's doing it this Saturday.
Well, you know, because of the international dateline and Greenwich and the progression of time zones, I don't know if they all started exactly the same time.
But around the same
there is a
time.
Window that they're supposed to kind of adhere to, yeah.
The 20th of October is the agreed upon date. It was started a number of years ago by a publishing house, actually, called About Comics, and they were publishing a collection of 24-hour comics that had been done McLeod came up with the concept 10 years before that, and they were kind of publishing their selection, or actually Scott McLeod's own personal selection of his favorite 24-hour comics that had been done over the preceding 10 years. And he...
And many were done by professionals in the field, not just aspiring.
So this has been going on quite some time.
Mm-hmm. Right. It was begun like with comics professionals, basically. It was a challenge from Scott McLeod to a well-known cartoonist friend of his, Steve Bissett, who worked with Alan Moore on the Swamp Thing series. And he does very beautiful, very intricately rendered artwork. And he puts out a comic maybe once every 10 years. He's not exactly prolific, and McLeod observed him doing sketches at a bookstore signing for people who would come in, and he'd just do sketches on the spot, and they were fully rendered, detailed, beautiful sketches, but he'd have them done in like 10 minutes, and Scott was kind of like, Steve, why don't you do more comics? Why is your catalog so small? And Steve was like, well, it's not like doing those sketches. And McLeod got to thinking about it, and he dared him to to do this 24-hour comics challenge.
And he rose to the occasion.
And Steve Bissett rose to the occasion. And then, of course, Scott McLeod had to follow suit, having laid down the challenge. And then he thought, this is a brilliant creative tool. And he wrote down the official rules, and he started promoting it just amongst other comics pros that he knew, and the legend kind of grew. And like I said, 10 years after that, this publishing house put together a book, and I think mostly as a promotional tool for the book that they were releasing, they decided they would have a day of 24-hour comics, and they contacted a lot of comic book stores as well as educational institutions, and they put up a website and said, you know, on this day we're going to do 24-hour comics. And then Scott McLeod will go through the 24-hour comics done on this day and pick his favorites, and we'll put out another book of comics just created on the day. And since then, we've had an annual 24-hour comics day.
And it's caught on all over the world. Mm-hmm. So what's it like? What is the experience like for you, Jet Boynton, of doing this?
Is your brain melted by the time it's over?
It's definitely a brain-melting experience. It's ridiculously strenuous considering you're sitting in one place pretty much. But sitting can get very hard after about 20 hours of it. You want to do anything but sit. And
like you just want to go to sleep.
Yeah, pretty much. I've spent plenty of sleepless nights over the years, for one reason or another. I'm not totally alien to the all-nighter, but it seems as the years progress forward, the all-nighter takes more and more out of me, and I get less and less back.
It is very much like a marathon. I mean, like a dance marathon or anything else. Or the way I think about it is this: if you take Steven Spielberg, give him a handheld digital camera and 24 hours and say, okay, you have to make an entire film all by yourself. You don't have any crew. I mean, you have actors, but they're just, you know, around you, and you just have to shoot them, and you have to make a movie out of it. It would be kind of similar.
There is, actually, I think, following the 24-hour comics challenge, a filmmaking challenge that is – I think it's a 3-day filmmaking challenge.
There's a 3-day or weekend long novel writing challenge, which a friend of mine did and produced a wonderful novel that got an honorable mention, that the winner gets published in the novel thing.
Yeah, maybe there's some kind of, I don't know, spooky, sleep deprived, zen kind of state that you reach after a while. I think that's one of the things that Scott McLeod is trying to push people for by inventing this activity.
Well, your ideas certainly get weirder and weirder as the time goes on.
Yeah. If you read a 24-hour comic, they definitely degenerate into this spiral of lunacy toward the end.
Well, I have in my hand here this book called 24-Hour Comics, edited by Scott McLeod, that you have in your store. And it is very interesting. There's some twisted thought in there.
Mm-hmm. It's a lot of 24-hour comics seem to take a very dark turn.
Indeed.
I think possibly just the desperation of the ticking clock and the lack of sleep.
A lot of splash pages toward the end, too. Splash page is what they call a page that is just one big panel, right, as opposed to several
lots
small
of little
panels.
Squares, right.
Common occurrences in 24-hour comics, and actually there's like a page count measure, too. I don't know exactly what it is, but there oftentimes are blackouts, I think, somewhere about the middle of the book where you'll have several solid black panels or a just completely black page with word bubbles on it.
Why'd the lights go out? I don't know, Bill.
Or, you know, long about page 17, perhaps you have a sudden unexpected blizzard with a bunch of white bison wandering through.
Ah, the old white buffalo in a snowstorm.
It's the visual equivalent of what my friend calls cognitive dropout.
Yes.
I think maybe I'll do a polar bear story this year. There you go.
So when all
you can't
of this
think about it ahead of time, though. Cheater.
I blew it.
People can start on October 20th at noon, finish October 21st at noon. Then is there a forum for people to share their 24-hour comic work with one another?
I think there may be a website this year. They're not publishing a book anymore.
They are, however, collecting pieces. Well, they ask that people send copies rather than originals, but they're going to be putting a gallery show together for a university.
Well, what about in Santa Fe? I mean, how many people are doing it in Santa Fe or Albuquerque, New Mexico?
There's usually a couple of dozen crazies there.
And do you show each other your work?
Oh, certainly. In years past, we had to kind of cap it. I always decided the appropriate number was 24 people since it was 24-hour comics. But even at that, you know, the comic shop's kind of filled to bursting.
So you do it at the comic shop?
Mm-hmm.
Seems like a good environment for it. There's
there's a lot of reference on the shelves. You know, people say, oh, I don't know how to draw a Roman gladiator, and they run over and they grab 300 or something.
Right. There's two concurrent events happening in New Mexico this year. There's one down in Albuquerque at the Harwood Art Center. They've generously volunteered their space, which is a fantastic old Gothic school building. So that'll be an exciting place. Probably a lot of spooky stories coming out of there.
And are you doing it, Chris, at your shop?
At True Believers. Our new location is 801 Cerrillos, for those that don't know. If you've driven by the old location on Guadalupe across from Tomasita's, you know it's a big hole in the ground right now.
Right, right.
So we're at 801 Cerrillos. It's right near Whole Foods. It's kind of hard to miss. There's a little Adobe strip mall there. Please do, if you're thinking about doing a 24-hour comic on the 20th of October, come in beforehand and sign up. We need you to sign a waiver that says you won't sue us if you fall asleep and hit your head on the floor, which may very well happen. And also just so that we know who's coming and how many are coming, because at some point we are going to have to say no more. So,
and the telephone number over there is 992-TRUE.
Very easy to remember.
T-R-U-E.
992-TRUE.
What are the numbers?
8783 for the alphabetically impaired.
Yes.
992-TRUE.
Well, Chris Diesler and Jet Boynton, thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And Jet Boynton is a cartoonist, and Chris Diesler is the general manager of True Believers Comics and Gallery at 801 Cerrillos Road. You're listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. I'd like to introduce Leslie King. She's the author of King of the Road, Adventures Along New Mexico's Friendly Byways, published by New Mexico Magazine. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks.
So this is a book that's actually a collection of your columns of travel writing in New Mexico Magazine. How did you start doing travel writing, and especially focusing on New Mexico, so close to home?
Well, let's see. I've always loved traveling and traveled all over the world. I grew up in New Mexico and sort of left because, oh, I thought it was sort of provincial, I guess. And so I went, really looked all over the world for where I wanted to live. And of course, I ended up coming back here because it's so great and sort of provincial too. And so I taught writing for many years at the college level, and then I just made the big step to integrate my traveling in with my writing. And it immediately was one of those stories of, you know, do what you love and, you know, the money will follow. I just took a leap of faith and it really happened for me. And it's continued to happen. So that's how the writing happened. And the column came about because I write for Frommer's Travel Guides, so I know New Mexico very well. And I had a book come out from a new book with Frommer's. And so I guess John Bowman at New Mexico Magazine must have seen that book, and he liked it. And so he offered me the column. And he came up with the name, which I think is great, you know,
King of the Hill. Put on your own last name.
Yes, yes. And it's very apropos. So what happened with the reason I ended up going the places that I go to these little towns is sort of by default, really, because when they offered me the column, they said, well, you can write about anywhere you want in New Mexico. And I was like, great. And except really we want you to kind of stay away from the main three, Albuquerque, Santa Fe, and Taos, because we already cover those so much already. And I said, okay. And then I started proposing places that are a little larger, like Ruidoso or Aztec. Oh, no. We already have features going on those. And so I just was so frustrated. I pulled out the map and I looked for places that I had never been and that I was curious about, maybe just because of the name, like Dulce or Luna or, you know, Lovington. And I was like, well, I wonder what's there. And so I started proposing these little towns, and my editor said, go, you know, and so that's what happened.
So you would get in the car by yourself?
Well, sometimes by myself. Sometimes I started taking my mother along, who's just sort of this very gregarious woman, and she's such a great entree into these little towns because she'll just strike up a conversation with anyone. And so she – and much more so than – I am. So, and then I started taking my father along too, you know, separately because they're not together anymore. And so they became, I don't know, when you have someone with a lot of years on them, people really like that. They like to talk to older people. And so that became sort of a part of my column too, was having my family members with me.
So how did you decide what you were going to do in each town? You'd pick out a little town just from its name on the map. And what would you do next? I mean, how did you find out what the heart of that town was about?
Well, that was actually the really scary part because, you know, probably you as a radio person really get this, that when you start into something like this, you have to totally just stay in the now because you don't have any idea what's going to happen. And you can really get into fear, like, what if nothing happens? And so if you stay in the now and you just trust every moment, what does tend to happen is things start unfolding. So sometimes I would go to a town where maybe there's not even a store or any business that you could just walk into and say, hi, what's happening in your town? And in that case, I just have to go, like, knock on someone's door. And what would happen is, like...
That's scary.
It was scary, but people were so nice when I would explain who I was and what I was doing there. And they would so often just invite me into their homes, and they would just sit and tell me their stories. And that's how these columns started. What started happening with them is that the people themselves of the towns tell the history and the story of the town. So it's told through them. So, you know, it's like, and a lot of times the people who, in these little towns, like, they are the history. So, you know, when I went to Puerto de Luna over by Santa Rosa, I mean, I met one of the people from the oldest families in Puerto de Luna, the ones that settled it, and, you know, sat, you know, walked through her chili fields with her and picked chili with her and her little grandson while she told me all the history of the town that was, you know, not, she didn't read it in a book. Yeah.
We're talking to Leslie King, and she will be speaking at Collected Works Bookstore on Friday, October 19th at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. What were some surprises that you got on some of these visits?
Oh, well, there've been just every trip is a wonderful surprise just because something magical seems to always happen as long as I keep the attitude that I'm there to give and not to get something. if I'm just there to give my attention and my appreciation for these people, they just totally open up for me. But one thing that happened that was really funny is kind of sad. I mean, this is sort of a travel writing thing where I don't want really any big impact to come to these towns from my writing about them. But this one time it did happen, actually. And I think what happened is I wrote a story about Rayma, which most people, even in New Mexico, don't even know where Rayma is. But it's over kind of near Zuni in the Gallup area on the western part of the state. And so I wrote this column about the, you know, there's actually no village. Well, there's a little village of Rayma, yes, but there's really not much there. And so I wrote about, they have a farmer's market there. They have a little gallery there and couple, you know, just that's about it, really. And beautiful, beautiful scenery, just beautiful. And so I wrote this column, and a few weeks later I get an email from one of the editors at Frommer's, who is asking me, they've decided that they're going to name Rayma, New Mexico, one of the 10 undiscovered destinations in the world. This is like ranking up there with like Bali, you know. And I'm going, Rayma? And, you know,
You're too good a writer.
I may be. I have no idea. But I'm just assuming. So someone, maybe a Frommer's editor, was traveling through New Mexico and somehow picked up my column and read it. And they made this decision probably without ever going there. I mean, Frommer's is a wonderful, you know, wonderful publisher. So I don't want to diss them at all. But they were really kind of just looking for something really remote, I guess. So anyway, I ended up telling – I sent them my column, which they basically just used, you know, to write this little capsule.
And did they really do it?
And they did. They named it one of the top undiscovered destinations in the world. And then, of course, you know, word got out in New Mexico about that. And suddenly it was on the front page of the Albuquerque Journal that, you know – so. And I was just sitting here going, you know, looking at the way, you know, they'd basically, you know, sort of taken my descriptions and put them in their own words, which I didn't, you know, I'm not attached to the writing part of it at all. But I just was just like, oh, gosh.
And so what happened to Rayma? I mean, did they have to build bed and breakfast?
Well, fortunately, Rayma is so remote that it didn't – I don't think it really impacted the place at all.
But, I mean, did people start going there?
Well, I think maybe more people have gone there, probably. And they've probably been they certainly wouldn't be disappointed in what they see because it's so fabulous. But, you know, there's really not much in the way of a restaurant and there's not much of a place to stay. And undiscovered is an understatement for Rayma, so –
We're talking to Leslie King. Her book is called King of the Road, Adventures Along New Mexico's Friendly Byways. There's a story that is not in the book because it happened after the book was published, I think, but you went to Santa Rosa expecting to find a music festival.
Yes, it was my most recent trip for my column. I proposed to my editor this Route 66 music festival for my column. And so just the day before, I called over there and I talked to the Chamber of Commerce and they said, well, actually, it's really not a music festival. It's a biker festival. And I was like, oh, no. And not that I have anything against bikers, but I actually when I finally went, I realized I was really afraid of bikers because, you know, the whole biker image is this very tough, snarly kind of black leather thing. And I'm just sort of like the opposite of that. So anyway, but I decided that if I was going to go to a biker festival, I was going to just really do it. So I did a little research before I went.
And did you change your outfit?
Well, I didn't really have much in the way of black leather. So I put on a black T-shirt and Levi's, and I have to wear running shoes when I work because I'm shooting photos and I just am running all around. So no black boots either. But I did find out that the mayor of Santa Rosa is a biker. You know, he has a bike. And so I called him a couple times. I had to be persistent and asked him if he would take me around on his bike while I was there so I could really get a sense of what it was. So I did go, and you know, the funny thing about it was, as I started interviewing these bikers and wandering around with them, there were hundreds of bikers and their noisy Harleys, and it was actually very beautiful. It was, the whole thing was just, it's this beautiful subculture that these people are really, it's an identity that they put on weekends and really live deeply, you know. And but they're such sweethearts, and this mayor was that way too. And he took me on his beautiful yellow Victory, which is a new kind of American bike, down to Puerto de Luna, where his family was from. And then he showed me all around Santa Rosa on his bike, and everyone, of course, knew him and waved. And it was a great trip. It was one of those wonderful surprises.
You must see some real regional differences in the cultures of southern New Mexico, northwestern New Mexico, central and northern New Mexico. What have you found? Are there real coherent subcultures in these places that you can identify?
Very, very much so. And I don't know of anywhere that would have such diversity as New Mexico. I just have to say that because what I've come to see is there are real regional differences from the south to the north. The northeast is such a ranching cultural area. You know, the west, the northwest is so Native American based, you know, and, you know, the southeast is sort of, you know, sort of a whole Billy the Kid and that kind of, you know, Old West thing. And
there's a story in one of your columns about the guy who claimed to have taken Billy the Kid's bullet out of a wooden wall or something.
Yes. I think that's in Puerto de Luna where he used to hide out there. Actually, he's somewhat of a hero in Puerto de Luna. You find out these other parts of it, you know, of these stories too, like why he was a hero, which was because he really did fight to help people keep their land. So, but anyway, but you know, what I really find too is that these, as well as the regional differences, these towns they're like whole worlds in themselves. I mean, you know, you'll go to somewhere like Luna that has the Mormon, you know, history. And I mean, it's the whole place has been shaped by the land, by the Mormons coming in, and those roots still, you know, really are visible today in the way people live their lives and what they do in their spare time and for their work. And they're just whole worlds when you go to these little towns.
And yet you are able to enter those worlds and be accepted and really engage with people.
Yes, I find that the people are, they're so friendly. And they invite me into their homes. I sit on their porches with them and talk about their history. And they're very welcoming. And you know, if people read this book and they want to go to these places, you know, some of them are set up for tourists, and you know, that's great when they are, and some of them aren't. And my only thing that I just tell people, and I don't know that I need to, but is that just they really treat the people and places with respect, and they will be totally welcomed. You know, if there's a no trespassing sign, you don't trespass. And, you know, you just try to move into their schedule, their needs, their timing, and give rather than take.
Leslie King, thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Leslie King is the author and also photographer.
Yes.
Of King of the Road, Adventures Along New Mexico's Friendly Byways, published by New Mexico Magazine. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website Santa Fe Radio Cafe, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.